There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
Right now, a historic moment. We can now project the winner of the presidential race.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
The president-elect of the United States of America, Donald Trump.
Donald J. Trump is the president of the United States elect.
This is a political upset of huge, huge magnitude.
Country still divided.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi and welcome, listeners of the 45th podcast. Good to be back. I am here this week with my colleague, Sara Basha. Susan's not with us this week, but anyhow, Sara, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. And how's your first week been? We're both fasting for Ramadan.
I'll tell you, it's not that easy as you age because you pile more onto your plate and your body's not what it used to be. So it's been a bit challenging, but it's also been nice to overcome the challenges of kind of going, oh my God, my throat's so dry, or I'm so exhausted, I want to take a nap in the middle of the work day, you know?
Are you able to do that? Can you just like sneak out? No, darn, that's too bad.
You know what? Where I work right now is like a startup, so it's grueling, but it's fun, and I love the people I work with, so it makes it worth it.
Well, that's good. I wish you well. I mean, like, I have had horrible sleep for like months now because the baby is like a little over 3 months. I have not had a full night's sleep in many months. And so the other night, my husband like just came crashing down in the bed next to me because, again, his sleep was interrupted because of Ramadan, not because of the baby, and was like, God, it is so hard. It's so hard to function when your sleep is interrupted. And I just had to hold myself back from from hurting somebody because I was like, ugh.
I think the getting up to pray and stuff is a little tough just because that's what breaks your sleep. And, you know,
you got to get up in the middle of the night to eat. We eat like at 4 a.m. before the fasting begins. But you know what? It has been an even longer week, I would argue, for members of the White House, especially Jared Kushner, which is where I want to start the conversation today.
Well, on a sidebar, I just have been very saddened by some of the uptick in violence in, you know, the Afghanistan bombing. I mean, those kind of things really bother me because this is supposed to be a month of reflection and, you know, self-improvement. And I just, you know, I think a lot of militant movements kind of take this opportunity during Ramadan to kind of emulate what they feel, you know, is one of those, the pattern of great battles that made, you know, made Islamic history. And it just bothers me that people think in such offensive ways.
But wait a minute. Okay, you're right, though. There has been an uptick in terrorist violence in, just in the last week, which I don't think, like, I think we see this almost every Ramadan for many, many years. It's been going on like this, especially since 9/11. But I find it odd that you think that there's that there is some kind of a emulation of some great, because many times these are attacks on, although in Kabul it was different, like in the diplomatic sector, but many, many times these are attacks on prayer spaces. That is not emulating anything.
I agree with you. I mean, my colleague and I at work were looking at the patterns of great battles that were fought in Islamic history, and just, you know, just side talk while we were working, and we looked at some of the big ones that happened, including the Battle of Badr, which was one of the main ones.
Major ones, right?
Yeah. So, but what's missing now is whatever the pretenses that existed for those wars in those days does not apply now. Now it's just this rabid, crazy madness that's very political.
Well, this is not war. A war happens when you have two state armies against each other. You have two fighting, you know, this is not war. This is terrorism.
Yeah.
This is, you know, militants attacking civilians. That's not war. And
But see, that's what we were talking about, how they justify fighting in this month because of the other battles that took place. And it's just a sick perversion. It weighs heavily on us. Yeah.
It is. It's terrible. It's terrible for Ramadan after Ramadan in a time that's supposed to be, like you said, one of spiritual kind of reflection and renewal, that there is such horrible bloody violence in many Muslim majority countries.
So tell me how Jared Kushner is making all that look kind of like not that important.
Well, I wouldn't argue that he makes it less important, but I will say that this signals an intensification of the Russia investigations, because there are so many of them. He is, I would say, of all the people who have been identified in these investigations as being a direct target, the highest placed White House official, the highest placed person closest to Trump, who's been specifically and publicly identified as being a target of one of these investigations. And that's that is a significant uptick, I think, in the investigation. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about first figuring out who Jared Kushner is, what his background is, and then what are the issues that he's being investigated for that we know about, you know, because I'm sure there's plenty of stuff behind closed doors that we don't know yet. But so let's talk a little bit about who is Jared Kushner. We know he is Donald Trump's son-in-law. He married Ivanka Trump in 2009, but much like Trump, he also grew up as the wealthy son of a family that made its money in real estate. Now their current real estate, that the mega fortune that the Kushner family owns, had some humble beginnings. His grandfather was a Holocaust survivor. He started a small construction firm in New Jersey, and then that firm went on to get into the real estate business, and they acquired, you know, decades ago, 4,000 rental units. Okay, they started off with 4,000 rental units in Newark, and that kind of became the foundation of their current empire. That happened, I think, in the 60s or something, 50s or 60s, but around the year 2000 and the mid-2000, and, you know, the New York Times reported heavily on this. It's a great piece, actually. It really goes into depth on, the real estate, how the real estate empire and how it's built up and what it's kind of based on, and also some of the really shady stuff, which we'll get into a little bit right now. But anyway, they started buying tens of thousands of these properties right before the market crashed around 2008, 2009. They were lucky enough, incredible timing, that they sold 25,000 units and made billions of dollars, basically. So that money came into the family. That huge amount of money came to the family when two important things were happening. Number one, Jared's father, Charles Kushner, was just coming out of prison. Folks might remember that Jared Kushner does not like Chris Christie, because Chris Christie was the prosecutor, the U.S. attorney, who put away Jared's father for tax evasion, witness tampering, and illegal campaign donations. Some really unsavory stuff. But around this time, they came into all this money. Charles was coming out of prison, and Jared was graduating from business school. And that's when they start buying some really big ticket items. I mean, properties worth a billion and up, hundreds of millions, skyscrapers and stuff. They're growing laterally too, which they start buying up tens of thousands of what are known in the real estate jargon as distress-ridden Class B properties. And these are properties that are mostly in places that are low income. They bought these properties in three states that were badly hit by the recession, the market crash, which was New Jersey, Maryland, Ohio. They currently own apparently about 20,000 units. And one of the largest acquisitions, ironically and strangely, is actually in Baltimore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. Baltimore. So much keeps happening in Baltimore. But these are low-income units, and they include Section 8 housing. One of the things that's been reported on what's happening in Baltimore, but also happening in the other areas where they own these properties, is what'll happen is, you know, Jared's company will come in, the Kushner company will come in, acquire properties that already have existing debts from tenants, you know, because these are often poor debt tenants. Sometimes they have to, they break their leases, they have to move because they can't afford the rent, they might owe some back rent. But as they're acquiring these properties, they are acquiring the debts, and they're going after them really aggressively, and some would argue viciously. So there are, even just in Maryland alone, there are over 500, we know, lawsuits filed against tenants by one of his companies, and there might be hundreds more filed, but because he has lots and lots of different companies, lots of subsidiaries, so it's kind of like slumlordy, I would say.
So there's a lot of money waiting in the pipelines with this litigations.
Yeah. I mean, so at the end of the day, even though it seems odd for them to throw lawyers and you know, a lot of these lawsuits are taking years, right? You go back year after year just to collect, let's say, $5,000, $3,000 from a tenant for whom it's almost impossible to pay, but they'll get wages garnished. And what happens is apparently they'll get the attorney fees back too. Because so, you know, they're kind of not losing out by doing this. And you're right. It's almost like another source of income going after these unpaid debts along with, you know, the rental income that exists. But so, you know, when Jared, you know, he's been a very important part of Trump's campaign and was really instrumental in the transition team and became a senior White House advisor, a senior advisor to Trump after the inauguration. He did step down from his company in the official position as he was leading it, but he does have a stake in the company that's worth about $600 million.
Well, isn't that like his father-in-law where he has stepped away from his businesses, but he still has a stake in them?
That is correct. Exactly. I mean, but again, like for people like him, Ivanka, who has her own business line, Trump, like anybody who has a stake in a business that could have any, that could be impacted by any kind of policy decisions that person is involved in. I mean, there's still ethical, you know, concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. That's always been a fine line.
Yeah. So, well, and here's the thing. So, a little bit about him personally, there's not a lot. He seems to be a pretty private person. I couldn't find a whole lot about him, like in terms of, like, you know, there's a lot that people have said about other folks who are instrumental in the White House, like Bannon and Miller. With Jared Kushner, there isn't a lot of personal information. One, I think, interesting note about him that I read are reports of how he seems to be a little bit, like, especially when it comes to business, he's pretty cutthroat, very vengeful. Mm. He owned this newspaper called the New York Observer, and more than once he pressured editors and writers there to write hit pieces on people that he thought were like his business enemies. So, you know, that's kind of a dangerous trait. But, well, anyway, he's in the White House now. And
I don't know. I reserve judgment on that just because I think all the information we get is from tertiary or more, you know, sources. And it's like Chinese whispers. I mean, I'm say facts are facts, yes. But, you know, in terms of who he is as a person and people's opinions of him, I don't really read too much into that because it's like how I deal with people in general. I just don't judge them until I have interactions with them, even if I've heard stuff about them that, you know, unless it's really egregious and it's like a red, you know, flag.
Well, the reports of him asking editors to write certain pieces actually have been corroborated by a number of sources. Now, what that means, we can disagree on. I mean, I personally think character is important. And also knowing kind of like what your ethical boundaries are, right, are important. And I think that could have something to do with how he's even, you know, part of the reason he's being investigated. But let's talk about some facts, though, in terms of what he's doing at the White House. And his portfolio, to me, is crazy. It is crazy for anybody who understands how D.C. works, how people are, like, in positions to take care of, like, one thing, maybe a couple of, you know, like one primary issue is like kind of their wheelhouse, but he has been assigned to head. So, I mean, he's heading up this new thing called the White House Office of American Innovation, which that one office.
Did he create that one himself?
I'm sure he created it in collaboration with others in the White House, but he is apparently kind of one of the thought leaders behind it because he believes, and he said, in quotes, that he believes America should be run like a great business corporation, you know, great business entity, and that the government should be run like a great business company. And under that premise, like this Office of American Innovation is supposed to be tackling domestic issues like veteran affairs, opioid addiction, workforce development, really unrelated stuff, but from like a business perspective.
Well, that's where his father-in-law and him click, I think, because everything has that business approach.
Yeah, I don't know how you apply. I mean, not everything benefits from a business analysis, though. I mean, like,
right,
I think.
I agree.
Yeah, anybody who works in policy has to understand that.
It's not all transactional, and it's not all about, you know, the money at the end of the day.
It's not all about the money, and it's certainly not about short-term gains. And I mean, especially, and the thing about business is, in business, you can file bankruptcy and walk away. You can't do that here. Like, you can't do that with people.
Well, you never know. You never know what that translates into with this.
Well, what that translates into is a broken democracy and destroyed citizenry. I mean, like, you're talking about walking away from people whose lives are going to be hurt.
Yeah,
but okay, so that's his part of his portfolio. Other things are like he's been kind of a shadow diplomat during the transition team. He was appointed, and he still is, as kind of the primary point of contact for foreign heads of state and diplomats. And people joke that he's the real Secretary of State instead of Tillerson, which I think is really problematic.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case. He might be the real entire White House counsel, but not the State Department.
Well, he's probably not replacing it, but we do know that during the transition period after the election that the Trump team specifically told foreign countries that when you contact us, you have to contact us through him. So that's weird. We saw pictures of him in Iraq. I don't know what he was doing there. What was he doing there?
Was that the trip before this other trip, right? I don't know. I didn't follow that. It was kept kind of, you know, quiet, relatively speaking, but maybe that was just because there was so much din happening in the country we didn't notice.
Yeah, there were those pictures of him in his flak jacket, you know, hobnobbing with the army. And it's, you know, again, to me, you know, does he have a domestic policy position? Is he working on military? Like, what is he doing? So he's been doing that.
I find him to be hard to read. He seems like a very tepid individual. You don't really see too much emotion on his face when, you know, he makes public appearances. I wouldn't say stoic, but it's just very, you know.
He's like quiet in the background, right?
Yeah,
like
you can't read him.
But having said that, he seems to be one of the most influential figures in the White House. He's got an office close to the president.
I would say the most.
The most. Yeah, there's been a bit of a power struggle between him and Bannon. And I think he has effectively sidelined Bannon to some extent. Hi, listeners of the 45th podcast, Rabia here, and I'm just going to check in briefly with one of our favorite sponsors, The Great Courses Plus. And actually, I'm checking up on you guys. I want to know if you have been watching the lecture series from The Great Courses Plus that I mentioned a few weeks ago, one of my favorites called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. And if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the one video in the series. They've got 24 videos in the series called The Bad Boys of U.S. Politics, which was all about the presidency of Warren G. Harding. Now, if you think our current presidency is riddled with scandals and corruption, well, you have to check this one out. And this particular lecture is just one of 24 in the entire series. They are all fascinating, all about forensics of so many different things. Forensics of the Jack the Ripper case, the Black Dahlia murders, political assassinations, Nazi Germany. I mean, really, it's fascinating. And this series is just one of over 8,000 lectures that you can choose from on The Great Courses Plus on all kinds of topics, politics, history, psychology, cooking, photography, everything you can think of. And you can stream all of these video lectures on any smartphone, tablet, laptop, and TV. You can even download the videos and watch them offline. Now, right now, you can sign up for The Great Courses Plus, and as one of my listeners, you can watch this and any of the courses free, absolutely free for an entire month, but you need to go to our special URL, which is thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. So start your free month today. Sign up at thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. Remember, it's thegreatcoursesplus.com/45. You know, and he's Trump's kind of go-to senior advisor on things. But having said that, you know, it makes these allegations about his Russia or possible Russia collusion even more problematic. And here's what's going on with that. This is why the feds are suddenly looking at, and numerous investigative agencies are now looking at him. Well, there's a number of reasons. First of all, he had a number of unreported meetings with Russian officials, okay? Again, they were not reported by Kushner originally. Later, maybe when he was confronted with them, I don't know what the circumstances were, he did report them. But when he was applying for top secret security clearance, he did not report these things, these meetings, including a meeting that happened in December 2016, during which he met with the Russian ambassador, who keeps popping up everywhere, and one of the really weird things that was suggested in that meeting is that Jared Kushner requested a, quote, back channel to Putin, which would be, yeah, a way to secretly communicate with Kremlin without being detected by U.S. intelligence. He even went so far as to suggest the meetings be held in Russian diplomatic facilities so that U.S. intelligence could not detect these communications. Now, that's the one we've been hearing about a lot. But there's a second secret meeting that Jared Kushner had that I think is equally troubling, and that was that he met during the transition, again in December, which was, I think, a couple weeks before this other meeting. He met with a chief executive of a Russian-owned state bank. In fact, this bank is the Russian state's economic investment global entity. They manage Russia's global investment. They also say that this bank is kind of like Putin's slush fund, and it handles transactions that he doesn't want done through like state budgets. So Jared Kushner met with the chief executive, okay?
Yeah. Okay.
Let's talk a little bit about the bank, and then we'll talk about the explanations about what that meeting was about.
Yeah, because my thing is, if the contact was before the election, during the campaign, and then after as well, what is it? I mean, do we have any inkling of exactly what these are about? I mean, is it just about money? Is it about, you know,
strategic? No, look, this happened in December. This happened in December as a transition, right before the inauguration. And this is
okay.
Right, after the election. Now, here's what happened. When they were asked about why this meeting took place, this is what the bank said. And the Washington Post reported this, and I'll quote it. The bank maintained this week that the session was held as a part of a new business strategy, right? Remember, because they're doing global investments, and was conducted with Kushner in his role as the head of his family's real estate business. Okay. Now, that can be problematic on its own right now because, you know, hello. Okay. He should not be profiting. His company should not be profiting because of his closeness to the administration. But the quote goes on to say that the White House says the meeting was unrelated to business and was one of the many diplomatic encounters the soon-to-be presidential advisor was holding ahead of Donald Trump's inauguration. So,
oh my gosh, right there is the murky line between personal business interests and you know, diplomatic efforts. I mean, how can we – yeah.
Well, here's the thing. This is a damned if this is a rock and a hard place for them because this bank is – it's not any old bank. And so that might clear up why, especially the second part of this, like the White House's response to this might even be more of a problem for them. And that's because this bank – and I don't even know if I should try to pronounce the name, but it's Vinesha Kahneman Banks, I think. But uh-huh. It is known for advancing the strategic interests of the president of Russia himself, Vladimir Putin. It's had a role in the past in the U.S. espionage case. And the bank's president, their chief executive, Gorkov, is a graduate of the Academy of the Soviet Federal Security Service, and which is the FSB, which is the domestic intelligence arm. He's a former Russian intelligence officer, okay? And he was appointed to this post as chief executive by Putin himself to the post about a year ago, okay?
Wait. So this bank is not, doesn't do official state business. It's just like something that Putin uses as like, you know, slush fund, kind of like his own transactions, or is it like an official state bank?
It is also an official state bank, and it's actually been under U.S. sanctions since 2014, since the Russia, you know, annexed Crimea. So it is an official state bank, but it is heavily managed by people who are basically, you know, the Kremlin, including, I mean, the current Russian prime minister, Medvedev, sits on the board of the bank, right? So this is not just any old bank is what I'm trying to get at. And so, you know, part of the problem here is if the White House is going to argue that, well, the meeting was part of these diplomatic things, we already know that one of the concerns of the intelligence probes is that Russia wants these meetings to help roll back sanctions, right? And so they're using these channels of communication and whatever influence they have over the president. We don't know what they have on him or why they're doing this. One of the goals is to get, you know, get rid of these sanctions. And so it doesn't necessarily help them,
this explanation. Yeah, and it actually goes, it's contrary to a lot of calls from people like John McCain who want to see sanctions vamped up because of their involvement possibly in the campaign. And, you know, here they're working back channels perhaps to, you know, tweak those sanctions in their favor. So directly, yeah.
You know, now this back channel apparently was never established, but, you know, what is the purpose of this back channel? He is so close to the White House, he actually gets... I mean, this is kind of weird to me.
Why did it never happen, though?
This I don't know. And that's an interesting thing that might come out in the investigations. Why did it not happen? Maybe they got too busy.
I don't think they got too busy, but
it could be that...
They came under scrutiny, or it was a time...
That's what I think it is. I think the Russians knew. I think the Russians know that they were being watched by the FBI. I think their intelligence is that good that they know that they are being watched carefully. And so, you know, there's a point at which these contacts don't become as useful. And they probably thought this is, you know, like even with Trump, you have to wonder what his usefulness is to Putin anymore. But you know, Kushner gets intelligence briefings every morning before the president does. And so I would not want something like that to have back channels undetected by the intelligence community, because that just...
Well, it's also part of just establishing a newfound relationship in terms of where Trump was in his power. And I think they're just adjusting that, perhaps. So maybe that's why these things never materialize or kind of look like they dropped off or just seem shaky.
Well, you know, like Trump, it's not just these meetings they've been having with Russian officials. I mean, Trump has had business dealings in Russia with Russian billionaires for a long time. And actually, so has Jared Kushner. In 2014, he started a company called Cadre, along with a Russian billionaire by the name of Yuri Milner, who is a main investor in the company. And so, you know, Jared Kushner also has like business ties that could potentially benefit from these relationships. And he's not supposed to allow, he should not be allowed to have that.
Could you even give the benefit of the doubt that because there were these pre-existing ties from 2014 that they were trying to meet to see how risky these ties would now be since the election? Or, I mean, am I just being too kind there?
Look, I mean, gosh, could he be getting together with the Russians to say, hey, you guys, we got to cut, we have to slowly extract ourselves from these relationships so I don't violate any ethical issues? I don't know. I would say no, because then it didn't have to be secret, number one. And number two, it would have been reported. And I think that's another concern, is that, you know, Kushner might have broken some laws by not reporting on his top secret security clearance forms these meetings.
It should have been more transparent, yeah.
Well, if the reason for your conversation, if your actual communications, the substance of communications are not nefarious, why do you have to hide them and then lie about even having them? I would say that it doesn't look good. The optics don't look good.
Yeah, that's the thing.
So this is all the stuff that, you know, Trump has come back to after his overseas trip, right? Like the trip we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks, the stuff was kind of building up and it became public during that trip. So he comes back to it. They are apparently heavily lawyering up. They have been being introduced to lots of different attorneys in DC and New York to include them on their team. They are creating this kind of war room situation, a rapid response team to get better in communications. Although I personally think communications and optics is not so much the issue. I mean, I think that ship has sailed.
Yeah.
Forget about that.
There's just too much stuff there. But you know, I'm not going to defend anything, but I did want to say that when the news broke that Jared Kushner was under investigation, I got kind of irritated because I'm like, you know, the moment we find something, we just blow it up there in the media. And in some ways, it could affect the outcome of any investigation or some moves that people make towards the investigation. So I just sometimes I feel like while we are a free and open society, there's sometimes when we shoot ourselves in the foot just because, you know, you put stuff out there. And that's why last week's episode, I mentioned how more nuanced the British are in their investigations and how they conduct it. Not to say that they're completely 100% great, but anyone is. But just to say that, you know, we're so quick to put stuff out there that, you know, it suddenly falls into all this noise. And in the end, you kind of can't differentiate between what's a story that's worth really, you know, concentrating on or something that's just fleeting.
Well, I will say this. I do agree that divulging ongoing investigations is never a good idea because it doesn't have an impact, kind of like what Comey did when he divulged the ongoing email investigation stuff before the election. Yeah, you're right. It can have an impact. But here's the thing. What we don't know is how long the FBI has been investigating Kushner. Although these meetings took place in two of the important meetings took place in 2016. He had meetings all the way back in April of 2016, way before these December meetings.
Yeah.
So it could be that the investigation, you know, do you think
it's already far along and they're just releasing it now?
It's ripe enough. It's ripe enough that the investigators are not worried about it having an impact is what I wonder.
Interesting.
Well, we'll see. And I have a feeling, you know, there are also reports that, you know, Kushner and Ivanka had moved to D.C. In fact, I think they live in Susan's neighborhood. she's not here to tell us about it. Yeah.
Wait, don't they live in the Obama neighborhood?
Well, I think it's the same neighborhood. Susan lives in that neighborhood. So, she's told me about the issues she'd had with just trying to get in and out and traffic and parking and stuff and you know, how tight D.C. is to begin with.
Oh, gosh.
But, you know, there are reports that, you know, Kushner is now kind of unhappy and him and Ivanka have thought about moving back. And every 6 months, they're going to, if they make it to 6 months, you know, we don't even know that at this point. But every 6 months, they're going to review whether or not they're going to stay in D.C. And, yeah, I mean, he's... it's starting maybe not to feel like such a great deal for him. So we'll see how things roll out. But that is what is happening with Kushner. That is who Kushner is. I think it's interesting that he comes very much from a background like Trump's, born into, you know, money.
Wealth.
But wealth made mostly on... at least where their fathers made their money and the grandfather, like on these kind of slummy deals, on low income housing. And, you know, Trump has a long history of that with his father's real estate.
There's something about the real estate dealing, the real estate world that's a little, you know, because there it's such a macro level of dealing that sometimes when you kind of cut the little guy out, you don't realize how many people you're hurting. So you kind of get ruthless with that kind of, because you have to think big and you have to think transactional again. So,
well,
I don't know.
I believe in karma.
Not that it's an excuse. Yeah.
It's not an excuse at all. But I, you know, the idea of making millions and billions off of people who, whether or not they rightfully owe you the money, but for who like $2,000 could destroy their lives. I just think karma's terrible. It's just horrible. It's a horrible way to make your wealth, is what I would say. And karma's a bitch. So,
I know people who hate tattoos, who love tattoos, and who think tattoos are plain weird. Most of the people I've met who have tattoos have great stories to tell about them, why they got them, what they mean. But I heard a great tattoo story the other day from the company that I get my socks from, Bombas. Bombas started when two guys named Randy and Dave heard that socks were the number one requested clothing item in homeless shelters. So for every pair of socks Bombas sells, they donate a pair to those in need. Pretty cool. So Dave promised Randy he'd get a Bombas logo tattoo when they donated 1 million pairs of socks. He thought it would take 10 years, but it only took 2.5. And now Dave has a Bombas tattoo and a great story to tell about it. If you're like me, a mom who wears heels to work, hits the gym when she can, and is always running about, your feet need some TLC, and there's just no sock out there that gives you the love that your feet need. I'm telling you, Bombas are the most comfortable socks I've ever put on my feet. There's no annoying toe seam, no falling down your leg, there's added arch support. They've solved every annoying sock problem imaginable. So for the best socks in the history of feet, visit bombas.com/45th today, and you'll get an additional 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/45th for 20% off. bombas.com/45th.
Sarah, you have, you're going to take us into one of the other big news items this week, which really is dominating the headlines for the last couple of days. And that is, I mean, it was like a reality show moment because everybody was on pins and needles. Trump's like, I'm going to make this grand announcement in the Rose Garden about whether or not I'm going to withdraw from the Paris Accords. And he did. So tell us all about this.
Well, before we start, I do want us to kind of take a listen to what he said and how he said it. Because if you look in the language very carefully, you will see that his argument is basically that this is a deal that does not benefit the U.S. So it's all about the same issue of job. Well, it's job creation. It's unfair treatment of the U.S. It's giving, you know, bringing everything back to the U.S. in terms of, you know, trade deals that we make. And, you know, I'm going to sort of maybe later on tie that into how he backtracked on TPP and eventually is going to incorporate some of the TPP features into NAFTA, and hope that perhaps this is one of those instances again where he's going to have to backtrack because, you know, climate change is an issue whether you want to accept it or not. And yes, I'm saying that as a conservative.
You go.
Well, you're saying you go, but it comes from my whole, I think it's a personal thing. It's a matter of faith for me. I think nature is supposed to work in balance with people, and we should put in an effort to understand that we've been given a responsibility on this earth to take care of the world. And
can I ask you this? In conservative circles, quietly, privately, secretly, is climate change denial, is this now the conventional understanding that it's not really happening?
No, people understand that it's happening. I think the biggest thing is, in comparison to other things, it's minuscule, or the cost of it is not as much as, say, in jobs or other things. So they look at it in a comparative sense, I think. Because look, you can't deny science, okay? It's staring you in the face. It's tangible. It's happening. But I think that they believe there's a leftist spin on it, whereas I think their attitude is, well, it's not as bad as they make it out to be. That's a feeling that I get. It's a media frenzy. It's been blown out of proportion. We're going to be okay. So let's listen to the statement he made from the Rose Garden.
All right.
The United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord. The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States to the exclusive benefit of other countries. Under the agreement, China will be able to increase these emissions by a staggering number of years, 13. They can do whatever they want for 13 years, not us. India makes its participation contingent on receiving billions and billions and billions of dollars in foreign aid from developed countries. There are many other examples, but the bottom line is that the Paris Accord is very unfair at the highest level to the United States. China will be allowed to build hundreds of additional coal plants. So we can't build the plants, but they can, according to this agreement. India will be allowed to double its coal production by 2020. Think of it. India can double their coal production. We're supposed to get rid of ours. Even Europe is allowed to continue construction of coal plants. I will work to ensure that America remains the world's leader on environmental issues, but under a framework that is fair and where the burdens and responsibilities are equally shared among the many nations all around the world. The fact that the Paris deal hamstrings the United States while empowering some of the world's top polluting countries should dispel any doubt as to the real reason why foreign lobbyists wish to keep our magnificent country tied up and bound down by this agreement. Thus, our withdrawal from the agreement represents a reassertion of America's sovereignty. It is time to exit the Paris Accord.
Okay, so What are the Paris Accords? Well, they were signed in 2015 by 195 countries, and it was considered a best effort to voluntarily pledge to curb greenhouse emissions and pressure each other in what's been known as climate diplomacy to avoid the 2 degree of global warming that happens every year. So it's not a legal document. There's no legal binding to it. It's just an agreement to cooperate. And of course, it was done under Obama. Some facts that we need to know in the background is that the U.S. is home to 4% of the world's population, but it puts about 1/3 of its emissions of carbon dioxide is coming from the U.S., of the world's CO2. It's also, the U.S. is also the second largest polluter in the world, and it has 1/5 of the world's emissions in general. So it's not like we can completely check out of this thing because we have a hand in it. So that's, you know, probably one of the most alarming things. So as of the Rose Garden speech, you know, let's run through some of the reactions. Some of the reactions have been, well, first of all, we don't know what the long-term reactions will be to this because there's policy stuff and other relationship issues that are going to be called into question going forward because this decision's ticked off quite a few people and entities. So basically now we have all this pressure on other countries other than the U.S. to work together without us as the second largest polluter. And it also puts pressure on other countries to either renegotiate the terms of it or scrap it or just go off and work on their own without us. It's been condemned by heads of state, corporate executives, all these climate change activists. And believe it or not, this has caused a huge problem internally, because there are staff and advisors and some of his closest confidants who lobbied him continuously. You know, France or Germany did it in the G7 meetings in Europe recently. They really pushed for it. But it's interesting to see that we've had some dissent in the ranks kind of thing here, where Ivanka has been personally reaching out to people like Dow Chemical's head to get him to pressure her dad into not leaving the agreement. We've had people...
And they did. And the heads of Dow Chemical, yeah. I mean, like they did. They didn't work.
Yeah.
They didn't want to. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's also been, but see, there's, even though you have like Elon Musk of Tesla and the Apple guys leaving the business council that Trump has.
The White House Business Council, yeah.
Yeah. There's actually this split in the middle. So you have the EPA admin, Scott Pruitt, and the White House strategist, obviously Steve Bannon, and counsel Don McGahn. They pushed for withdrawal from this treaty. But on the other hand, you have Ivanka, and then you have the chief of economy, Gary Cohen, and then Rex Tillerson, that are like saying, let's stay. But for, you know, it's not always, I think they look at the non-monetary ramifications of it. So
I got to say, you know, these are two really, really weird teams. I mean, for me, for you think about the head of the EPA saying we should withdraw.
Administration.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Administrative head of the EPA saying we should withdraw from this, along with the White House counsel. What does the White House counsel do? Well, he has no reason to have any say on this. Neither does Ivanka, by the way. So even the voices involved here, pro or con, that are in his ear. And apparently the morning that he announced that he's going to withdraw, he made a call to one of the Fox contributing hosts, this former attorney, to ask her, hey, what do you think I should do? I just don't understand how you made this decision. Yeah.
Well, because apparently he just followed his gut. Literally, I'm quoting, he made a gut decision on this. So Bannon said it was a product of globalism and it didn't satisfy Trump's base. But Ivanka said it weakens global image and the moral authority of the U.S. And her husband actually agrees with that. But he said that we should sort of renegotiate the terms because it apparently is to him unfair to have developing countries like combat climate change using, you know, U.S. dollars. So there's been an internal thing, and let's see how that plays out over time. But it's interesting, though, for the first time, there's been a break in the ranks. And I think that's a stark example of how not having a cabinet with, you know, very qualified people who know what they're talking about when it comes to this stuff has led to sort of like gut reactions to things, gut decisions, and not infighting, but kind of disagreement within his closest circles. So
You know, if Bannon is saying that, you know, this doesn't satisfy his base, well, you know, Trump kind of spoke to that when he made his announcement. He said, I was elected by the voters of Pittsburgh, not Paris. Now, I thought that was kind of a really, really, almost like a breathtakingly ridiculous statement. Because number one, actually, he wasn't voted in, but Hillary got the vote from Pittsburgh. But
it's just a cliche statement. And
But here's the thing. Does he really think that because it is called the Paris Accord, that it represents Paris, that this is about Paris? Like, to me, that statement signals that he thinks this agreement is not like a, you know, do you see what I'm saying?
He was trying to say, and look at me trying to decipher that. He's trying to say that the coal jobs are where? In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, right? So it brings us to the whole point that I was going to bring up later, but we might as well do it now.
You are too kind, Sarah. You are too kind, but go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm not justifying. I'm just explaining it. But how big is that issue of coal jobs in Pennsylvania? And I looked into this a little bit, and I'm not a coal expert or, you know, an economist that deals in energy stuff and coal. But let's look at this closely, okay? The history of coal in this country is in the fourth quarter of 2016, the U.S. exported 19.3 million short tons of coal to lots of countries, the biggest being Netherlands, Brazil, South Korea. And then in the fourth quarter of 2016, it exported it to Colombia, Canada, Indonesia. Okay. So Trump is actually a shale supporter. So he's actually for natural gas, which is actually a competitive source of energy. And then natural gas is actually a much, you know, it's a cleaner and newer kind of thing. We export coal to China as well, by the way, and other places. And then there's been many issues with this claim that we need to bring coal back, because when you shut down a coal plant, how do you bring it back, right? And then there's many issues within the coal community, okay? There's black lung disease that happens with coal workers that we need to figure out how Obamacare, the you know, repealing of Obamacare is going to work out for those people. So I'm not sure they're like all dandy with this kind of stuff anyway. So the importance of coal is something that you need to call into question. If Trump's base, and let me just throw out a rough number there just for the sake of, you know, argument, if his base is like 10 million and it's like a huge part of that is coal miners or people who work in the coal industry, you know, you're going to cater to those, that little section, and forget about the rest of the 300 million people in our country. I mean, you have to be, he needs to put this into perspective. And I don't know if it's a grandiose goal for him to try to bring coal back in a time when it's clearly dying. It's kind of like trying to bring the oil back to
Saudi
Arabia.
Do you think he's going to really commit to that? I mean, like, I felt like that was a campaign promise. I don't think anybody's bringing coal back. It's not happening. Like you said, he's a shale guy. But at the same time, you know, fine, natural gas is, I prefer that we, you know, put our resources into like exploiting natural gas resources versus coal, because coal is so much more dirtier. But, you know, the administration, the Trump administration also, at the same time, is now trying to roll back an Obama administration rule that actually was cutting down on methane gas, methane leaks and pollution from oil and natural gas wells. So in a way, even though he, you know, I don't think he can bring coal back, and he might be more focused on, you know, ramping up gas resources and through fracking and stuff like that. But even then, he's rolling back regulations that makes it more harmful to the environment. So I just feel like he's like an anti-environment president.
Well, listen to, in light of what you just said, in 2008, we generated 48% of our electricity was generated by coal. And then in 2016, which is 8 years later, it's 30%. And by 2018, they're predicting that it'll be only 31%. So he's only going to increase it from 30.4% in 2016 to about 31% in 2018. So, you know, I don't know if it's worth this much is the thing. It's a trade-off. See, when you're running a country, you're not looking at one area. You have to balance everything. And I'm wondering where the balance is in that. So that was a very good point you brought up in terms of, you know, I'm catering to Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, and not Paris, is how important is the coal industry to us, and where are the trends going, and where is the market for that, and what are you really going to be doing for that small portion of your base? You know, it's interesting.
But here's the thing. This is what I don't understand about both with this discussion and the discussion we had last week about NATO is the idea, like, what am I getting back? Well, what you're getting back is being a global leader, being the most important, influential, powerful country in the world.
Yeah, but this is a whole anti-globalization kind of approach that he has. I mean, look, he just went and slapped the whole of NATO in the face publicly. I mean, you do these things behind the scene if you were pressuring people to pay their quote unquote dues. You do it behind the scenes, like that's what a diplomat, a statesman does. But you don't go out on a microphone in front of the whole entire world stage at a time when you're unveiling a memorial and just say, you know, pay up, guys. And they're all standing there, like not knowing if they should be grimacing or snickering. I mean, well, it's kind of
hard.
With both
NATO and this withdrawal, you know, many people are talking about, you know, what's really happening is that the U.S. is withdrawing as a world leader. We are no longer going to be. It's going to be China. It'll be India. It'll be another nation who is going to be like, you know what? The U.S. doesn't want to like commit to global peace, security, collaboration with the nations, energy, environment. Then we will, and we are going to be. I mean, like, do we really want to be an isolated third world country? Like, what are we trying to do here?
Well, Merkel's already headed that way. She's kind of like, well, if they're not going to join forces, there's going to have to be a new paradigm in the world, right? But he says it costs us $3 trillion in domestic economic activity and 6.5 million industrial and manufacturing jobs. And he's saying that it transfers all those coal jobs to China and India, and it puts international needs over American needs, and that European countries are basically determining how much energy the U.S. can use. So... but, you know, he said apparently he reassured the leaders of Britain, France, Germany and Canada that America, and I'm quoting this, that America remains committed to the transatlantic alliance and the robust effort to protect the environment. And I'm trying to think about, you know, how committed he is to that protect the environment part, you know, if it doesn't work out economically for him.
With Scott Pruitt heading up he's not. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying even when it comes to other forms of energy, he is showing that he wants to pull back regulations that have a positive impact on our environment. That is clear. And this accord was the first time that every country in the world came together to commit, you know, to reducing emissions. And by United States as a global leader pulling out, I mean, you know what? There's very little incentive then for other nations to then also be committed to this.
We're ultimately making a choice between prosperity and the environment. You know, why does it have to be a choice? Why can it not be a balance, right? I'm worried about the geopolitics of the world. This makes us less involved in other decisions. This is not just about the climate. It has ramifications, the sense that it's going to affect diplomatic ties. It's going to affect how we feel about how we all put our, you know, money into the pot together. It's going to affect trust and how we go forward, even with ISIS. So I don't know what the geopolitical effects of this will be. I think it's a lot bigger than just the environment. And I think that's what Ivanka was trying to get at. So
I wonder if he can roll that back if his gut changes its mind. I don't know. But I will say this, the resistance is alive and well. And there are reports that I think over 60 mayors, and I don't know about governors, but 60 mayors have already said that they're going to, U.S. mayors are going to hold their cities to the standards of this accord, even though the U.S. has withdrawn.
Well, I have two things to say. I have a prediction and I also have a statement. The statement is, when you come to the table saying, I'm going to like blow a hole in this one issue, I just don't like it, you have to find a replacement. So when I go to the drawing board at work and I go, guys, we need to fix this one aspect of something, I suggest an alternative. You just don't go in there and say, I'm just going to take this little peg out and just hope everything works. You know, you don't do it that way. You go, instead of this peg, I'm going to substitute it with this. And here's a solution that's different, right? So my question to the administration is, what is the renegotiated or new deal like? Like, what is that? He hasn't even put one forward for us to say, oh, you know what? He's giving us this alternative. Let's look at it. Nothing, right?
Nothing.
And the other thing is, my prediction is, just like what I mentioned in the beginning with TPP, When something as tangible as climate change is being ignored, you have to reckon with it at some point. So I think he's going to have to backtrack on this. I think the pressure will be great, especially when you have, you know, Apple and Tesla and people like that walking out on you. It's not just that. It's also the fact that you can't deny reality, and you're going to have to at some point realize you're isolated on the world stage, and that's not the way to be a world player.
I totally agree with you. Totally agree with you. Well, thanks so much for that discussion, Sarah. All right, so let's do something we haven't done in a few weeks, which is take some listener comments. This was maybe the first piece of like a hate mail that I've gotten. I don't think I've gotten any hate email for this podcast.
What?
I've gotten
hate.
I got hate email. It is hate email. But here's the thing. I want to talk a little bit about the substance of the hate email because, you know, it's fair to hate on a position I take. But here's where this listener kind of rubs me the wrong way. It's not about the substance of his argument. His name is Joshua, and he wrote a very, very long email. And he started off very nicely, and he said, you know, he's followed me through Undisclosed, and he supports the work that I've done for Adnan. And he says, you know, you're a strong voice for women, blah, 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 great stuff. But he says in our last episode called International Incidents, that was the name of the episode, I made a comment that, quote, has offended me to the point that you have lost all of my respect. So I'm going to read portions of his very long email. He says, Sara was making a good point about immigrants and their responsibility to take responsibility and assimilating to their new culture. And clearly you don't understand the term assimilate based on your response. Nobody wants or expects an immigrant to convert to a new culture. It would deaden the wonderful effect that multiple cultures has on our country. What assimilation means is embracing the culture of the people around you instead of isolating yourself in your native culture. Despite the non-threatening attempt in Sarah's argument, you said that to assimilate as an American would mean buying guns and getting a Bible. That comment was maddeningly ignorant and offensive and is not appreciative of the opportunities this country has given you and entirely disrespectful to what I imagine to be the vast majority of your listeners. You should be ashamed of yourself. Your true colors came out in that comment and you seem like nothing more than a bitter false victim.
This is so...
Wait, I'm not done. Blaming America for the failure of your own belief system to confront its own weaknesses. One more paragraph and I'm done. There's an ongoing and very serious battle going on between two Americas right now. There is conservative Christian right and the liberal agnostic left. You blew up the former to represent the totality of the country, suggesting that people like me, an agnostic liberal, is somehow beneath you because you assume we are all ardent religious zealots with arsenals. Make no mistake, that's where you come from, not where I come from. All right.
Wow.
He goes on talking about, you know, he has a Harvard degree, he's an activist, and how he's against gun rights. So there's a couple of things going on here. Number one, he talks about the substance of my comment about what does it mean to be assimilated? What is American culture? What are the values, you know, that this country is known for and prides itself on? I am going to double down on that comment because absolutely, absolutely, pride in the Second Amendment. This is Middle America. This is between the coasts. The Second Amendment is part of the value system in this country. There's no way around it. Owning a gun, it's a point of pride, okay? The Bible is a point of pride. Yes, and I'm not saying these things are tied together necessarily, but definitely the Bible Belt, which is known to be like, you know, the Middle America, is also known for being very pro-Second Amendment, pro-gun rights, pro-gun ownership. And I'm going to double down on my contention that America does have a problematic culture of violence. We are number one in the world, not in things like healthcare, but number one in the world on gun-related deaths. We are number one in the world for reported rapes. We are number one in the world for things we don't want to be number one in the world. And on top of that, we have the most active military. We are involved in the most conflicts around the world. So don't tell me the violence is not a part of American culture.
But wait, Robbie, I totally look. I have, I mean, that touched my heart because I know you as a person and to see you get chopped down like that, it's painful to me because it doesn't personify everything that you feel on the subject either. But I have to say that the reason we are also number one is because our population is proportionally huge compared to one other single country. If you're looking at continents, then maybe you can argue, but you know, you have to look
well,
at
you
the
can
data.
Make the, you can make the com- no, 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 but this
but
is not
I
just about population. This is also about per capita. I mean, like you can look at a place like India or Pakistan. Gun ownership is not a thing. It is not a thing. It's not a part of an ethos, a culture, a constitution in other nations. It's just not. So, but here's the thing. But we can disagree on these issues. Maybe I will absolutely consider the legitimacy of the argument that no, violence is not part of the American culture. Okay, fine. I think there are arguments to be made both ways. But here's what I thought was really interesting, which jumped out at me. He goes on to say that you outed yourself. He goes on to say that you are a bigot against America. This is what he said. He said, number one, the opportunities that this country has given to you. Okay. Number two, he said, that's where you come from, not that's where I come from.
Yeah,
so here's what I would like to say to Joshua. Yeah. I am an American. This is where I come from. I am talking about my country. Okay. I'm saying this in the nicest way possible. The bigotry embedded in his comment that that's where you come from, not where I come from, is what really smacked me upside my head. The idea that this is his country and not my country. Like, why? Why is he even making that argument? What about me makes this not my country?
You know, I think the tone of that is just a little emotional. I think he needs to, you know, understand that that's, you know, we're on a podcast. We're not writing a book here. You can't explain everything in one shot.
No, but I want him and others to like really think about that. Like, because I know that plenty of people don't realize what they're saying when they think those kinds of things. When he says the opportunities this country has given to you, my father served this country in the U.S. government for like decades, okay? We have given back this country because this is our country, like anybody else. So the idea that I am not allowed to critique my own country because you perceive it not to be mine, that is what I call bigotry. So I just want to, I'm going to say that substantive argument, make the argument, but coming at me in that way, that is where the bigotry lies. And I think that's where he lost me on the point when you other me like that. I'm sorry, Joshua. All right. Mm-hmm. Sarah, you got anything?
Yeah, I have one from Liam Gordon, and I'm just going to pick out a little piece of what he said about my last talk on comparing apples and oranges when I was whining about how scholars in some of the Muslim circles where you know, people who are learned about this topic talk about how gun violence in America is a much more you know, a disproportionately bigger threat to us on a daily basis than terrorism coming from, you know, Islamic terrorism or Islamists, I should say. And he writes, on the gun violence versus terrorism thing, white men with guns are terrorists. I don't agree at all that it's comparing apples to oranges. White men opening fire in a black church or a school is 100% terrorism. It's just not Islamic terrorism. I think it's quite toxic to exclude white supremacists or other whack jobs from the discussion of terrorism. It exacerbates the anti-Muslim sentiment, which then ostracizes young Muslim people and makes them even more likely to be driven to violence. Terrorism, in my eyes, is anything ideological, be it in contortion of a religion or an idea of race, politics, and whatever. So to Liam, I'm not saying that I disagree. I had said that I don't disagree, that it's a huge problem. But when you're walking into a conference that's talking about the problems with Islamist movements that are spreading terror everywhere, turning violent, you cannot sit down and compare it to something else and tell us that we should or shouldn't spend more or less time worrying about one or the other thing. It's completely different. We're talking about gun violence is about, you know, gun laws in this country. We're talking about a whole other gamut of stuff. And to equate those two is sometimes I get the feeling that what we're doing is whitewashing the issue and just saying, well, you know, it's just not such a big problem. Why are you guys making such a big deal of it in the media? Well, actually, it's a very unpredictable, sporadic, much like gun violence type of problem. And it is another problem of a different, entirely different making. But that doesn't, it shouldn't minimize, one and the other should not minimize each other. It just, I think that was what I was trying to get at. Yes, gun violence is an issue. I worry about my kids being on lockdown at school, and it's happened before, and we don't really know half the time if it's a real attack or not, but that's always looming. But the problem is you cannot compare these movements by Islamists in the other parts of the world and the threat that they pose the same way as, you know, just the ramifications of gun laws in this country.
Well, you know, I think you're right. You cannot compare these things, number one, because when we're talking about gun ownership in the United States, we're talking about a legal phenomenon. It is legal to own a gun. And so we're talking about how to regulate something that we aren't basically legally entitled to.
No, but
Robbie,
it gets also into mental illness. It gets into how we handle violence, all those other issues, but they're different.
They're different. There are times when gun violence is terrorism legally by legal definitions, and there's times when it's not. I think you're right. You know, I don't know if it's the same listener, but somebody wrote an email saying that, you know, talking about these two things separately is like being in a house that where there's a fire happening in the kitchen, but there's black mold growing in the basement. ISIS and terrorism being like being the fire and the black mold that's growing, which is also going to destroy the house, by the way, being the gun violence. So I agree. Yeah, I agree that they're two different things. But having said that, you know what is similar? What is similar to the jihadi Islamist type of threats that we are facing are threats of white nationalist militancy. And that's something actually I want to talk about next week. So because there's been an uptick in those kinds of attacks too. So thank you so much, Sarah, for responding to our listener. And next week we're going to get into a conversation that I think is going to be a little bit tricky if we have folks like a former other listener, Joshua, or maybe he's a former listener. I don't know if he's listening anymore. But we're going to have the conversation. So,
well, I am having Susan withdrawal, so we need to get her back on.
Yes, hopefully she will join us next week. There was a point at which I was like, Susan, I demand proof of life because I have not heard back from her on emails, on text messages, and she's really, really, really been overwhelmed with a lot of her work nowadays. So anyway, wish you best luck in the next week of fasting, Sarah. And
you too. And I don't know how you're doing it as a new mom, but
I am going to pass out right after
kudos.
We record this. Yep.
Go take a nap.
I will do that. And the listeners of 45th will be back next week. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for tuning in again this week. And we really hope to keep coming to you weekly. But in order to do that, we do need your support, so please consider becoming a patron of the 45th Podcast. To do that, just go to our Patreon page. It's www.patreon.com/45thpod. Again, that's patreon.com/45thpod, and Patreon is spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. A big thank you, of course, to everybody who helps make this show possible, beginning with our fantastic sponsors. Thank you for supporting us. Thank you to Ray Gaines for our audio production, our kick-ass producer, Mithal Telhan. Thank you. You are the best. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Please do check out our website at www.45thpod.com. And you can reach us and leave us your listener messages, which we love to check into, at 202-670-8345. Again, it's 202-670-8345. Thanks again. See you guys next week. Week with my colleague, Sarah Basha. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. Not Sarah Basha anymore. It is a Sarah Basha jokes. I keep wanting to call you something else for last night. I got it right. Even with my fried Ramadan brain, I'm so sorry.
Aww, that's okay.